You know, every great war produces its great hit songs. And after each war, we like to gather around the piano or the guitar and play these songs. We enjoy the songs because they remind us of how much we enjoyed the war. Now, World War III is almost upon us, as you know, by popular demand, it seems. And it occurred to me that if any songs are going to come out of World War III, we better start writing them now.
So long, Mom, I'm off to drop the bomb, so don't wait up for me. But while you swelter down there in your shelter, you can watch me on your TV. While we're attacking frontally, watch Brinkley and Huntley describing contrapuntally the cities we have lost. No need for you to miss a minute of the agonizing Holocaust. Yeah!
Welcome to another edition of Crawdads and Taters. That was Tom Lehrer, U.S. musician and political satirist, who wrote this song, So Long Mom, in 1965. Lehrer's satirical music became very popular in the 1950s and 60s as he sang about the political issues of his day. And we were able to bring you this song because Lehrer has put all his music into the public domain. What a good leftist. Rumor has it he retired from satire when Henry Kissinger received the Nobel Peace Prize.
That's a good time to retire. Yes, indeed. We are talking about the atomic bomb and Hollywood's treatment of nuclear war today in light of the recent blockbuster film Oppenheimer. According to the Union of Atomic Scientists, the doomsday clock is closer to midnight now, that is, closer to doomsday, than it's ever been in human history. And as the United States continues to send billions of dollars to Ukraine to fight a proxy war against Russia, while ramping up its hostile rhetoric toward China, our country is taking us closer and closer to the brink of nuclear war with these major nuclear superpowers. And as we know, there's only one country in the world that has ever used a nuclear bomb against civilians. And that country, my friends, is the United States. So we thought we should take a closer look at the movie Oppenheimer and Hollywood's overall treatment of U.S. nuclear proliferation, since so many people in this country use Hollywood and the mass media as their main information source for U.S. history.
Before we get started, we want to give a shout out to our patrons on Patreon, our recognized rebels, Todd Munson, Old Left, Kenny Jones, Janae Saliba, Greta Hunneke, and our VIP rebels, Ben Andrews and Liz Font. Thank you so much for supporting us.
Yes, thank you. Thank you.
If you want to support us, please go to patreon.com/crawdadsandtaters and sign up and support us.
Yes, thank you so much. We appreciate it from the bottom of our hearts. We know that we don't get you these podcasts super often. So we always try to make up for our frequency with the depth of our research when we do get them to you. So we really do appreciate your support.
Thank you so much. On with the show. July was a big month for Hollywood. Two blockbuster films were released on the same weekend, Barbie and Oppenheimer. We're going to be focusing on Oppenheimer this episode, but it was actually outsold by Barbie, which brought in a whopping $162 million on opening weekend and has passed $1.18 billion at the time of our recording, almost twice as much as the $650 million Oppenheimer has brought in so far.
Well, I have to say, Taters, that I find the timing of the release of these two movies to be kind of ironic. I mean, here we are in the midst of this massive Hollywood labor strike. Actors and screenwriters on strike together for the first time since 1960. And while Hollywood productions are grinding to a halt over labor issues, the film industry releases these two major blockbusters of the summer, both of which whitewash and sanitize major atrocities in U.S. history. Oppenheimer wants to maybe, possibly be an anti-war film, but actually leaves you guessing as to whether or not it is or is not, because it completely glosses over all the actual atrocities and the long-lasting devastation of the atomic bomb and the nuclear testing surrounding it. And then Barbie, a doll that is largely responsible for generations of women suffering from low self-esteem and body image issues, tries to redeem herself as a feminist icon in order to, wait for it, sell more Barbies.
I didn't see the Barbie movie, but my guess is that it was basically a 2-hour Barbie commercial. That's what I got from watching the trailer, at least.
Yep. Well, I did see the movie because I kind of had to understand what all the hype was about. And I can see that the writers really did intend to address Barbie's problematic elements, her complexities, her stereotypical white blonde identity, and so forth. But at the end of the day, what you have to understand is that Hollywood is trying to redeem Barbie's image because Mattel Films is marketing itself now as a new movie production company in order to make a buttload of money. So now they're trying to sell us the new and improved woke Barbie. So it's kind of like, hey, everybody, Barbie's woke now. She's got all kinds of different racial and ethnic identities. And now she's traveling to the real world to dismantle the patriarchy. So come watch our 2-hour commercial for how this fantastical doll is going to change the world. And then buy more Barbies.
Okay. Yeah. I'm glad I didn't see it. Thank you for suffering through that. That just sounds ridiculous. This is really a problem when audiences don't have a class analysis. They see that Barbie's got all this new woke consciousness, and then they feel good about themselves for going to support the movie and make Mattel a bunch of money. But they miss the obvious reality. Barbie's not going to save the world. And this entire premise that you can enact real social change by buying more Barbie products is a delusional capitalist fantasy.
I know. It's so pathetic. And honestly, I kind of feel like it's downright insulting to generations of women who have really suffered under Barbie dolls. I mean, now they have all these diverse Barbies from different cultures. And I think there's even a trans Barbie now, which is super cool. But in my generation, Barbie was always a white, blonde-haired, blue-eyed, anatomically incorrect, totally sexualized doll with body measurements that were physically impossible to achieve no matter how much you starved yourself. And this super perfect, idealized version of women's bodies has been the role model for little girls for generations. So no wonder women and femmes have so many epidemics of eating disorders, low self-esteem, plastic surgeries, suicide attempts, and all kinds of devastating body image issues. And I get that Barbie was supposed to be a liberatory step up from the baby doll that trained little girls to become mothers. But the next thing capitalism sold us after the baby doll was a new form of patriarchy. The idea that we girls could all become blonde-haired, rich, blue-eyed, skinny sex objects with gorgeous blonde boyfriends named Ken, who drive fancy cars and live in mansions.
Right, and that was supposed to be a social advancement.
Exactly. And so here you have Mattel trying to rebrand itself in the middle of a massive Hollywood labor strike, in the middle of global climate collapse, global wars, pandemics, and mass poverty. But now Mattel wants to give Barbie depth and nuance and wisdom and empathy and courage to travel the real world and take on patriarchy. In other words, Mattel is trying to sell us a humanized Barbie who goes to the gynecologist and wants to help other women.
Oh, that's so sweet. Barbie has such a good heart. What's the message to all the women who for generations have felt bad about themselves for not looking like a Barbie doll?
Well, I guess we're just all supposed to think that we got it wrong the whole time because we misunderstood her. You know, she really had all this depth and nuance, and now we should just really love Barbie. Why? Because Mattel needed an economic boost, and maybe its market shares weren't performing well enough. And so it was time for a major rebranding campaign. And you know what I have to say to that? F you, Mattel, you shameless capitalists. And what an insult to injury to generations of women who suffered under your blonde-haired, blue-eyed capitalist patriarchy.
I think you really covered everything there. But I do want to bring in another perspective on Barbie.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. I didn't see the movie, and neither did Ted Cruz.
Oh, no.
He had something important he wanted to point out to
us. Oh, no.
Here's a clip of Ted Cruz. I think it was on Fox News. I'm not actually sure.
Okay, let's listen.
Now, I'm the dad of two young daughters. This is, you know, going to be a big movie, particularly for a lot of young girls. There's a scene in Barbie where there is this map of the world, and it's drawn like with crayon. I mean, it's really a very simple cartoon. And so they have this blockish thing that is called Asia. And then they've drawn what are called the nine dashes, which is, this is Chinese communist propaganda, which the Chinese are asserting sovereignty over the entirety of the South China Sea.
What? Holy shit! A communist map of Asia? You have got to be kidding me. I don't even remember any maps in the film.
Right, so a crayon map in a movie that is labeled Asia, not China, is somehow Chinese communist propaganda, so we shouldn't see Barbie. That's the analysis of Ted Cruz, and that guy ran for president.
Wow. I mean, today's Republicans really do have nothing to campaign on. They don't offer us anything, so all they can do is drum up a new Red Scare. Incredible.
Yeah, and that's something both them and the Democrats agree on, is new Red Scare against China. But speaking of this Red Scare and new Cold Wars, today the main topic of our episode is going to be about Oppenheimer. Not Oppenheimer the man, but Oppenheimer the movie. What it got right and what it left out. And spoiler alert, we will be talking about the movie, so if you haven't seen it yet, this episode will discuss some plot details. We're also going to be talking about the history of the nuclear arms race in the United States and how it's portrayed in the movie. We think having this understanding of U.S. nuclear history is absolutely critical right now as the U.S. ramps up its Cold War and potentially a nuclear war against Russia and China.
We also want to talk about the movie because we think this could have been an amazing opportunity to push a nuclear non-proliferation message inside a culture that has never come to terms with its own nuclear history. And as we said earlier, according to the Union of Atomic Scientists, the doomsday clock is closer to midnight now, that is, closer to doomsday, than it has ever been in human history. Closer now than during the Cuban Missile Crisis, closer now than during any time during the Cold War. So that's why we have to talk about where the U.S. stands with nuclear proliferation.
Right. That's something we should all be concerned about, but it seems to be largely ignored by mainstream media. First, let's talk about what the film does well. It does several things well, and Christopher Nolan is a very accomplished director who's made many great films, especially sci-fi and fantasy films like Batman, Memento, and Interstellar. No doubt Nolan is a fantastic director and producer, but the question is, given the political moment that we're in right now, is this the anti-war film that we need?
No, of course it's not. And we know that Hollywood, the capitalist establishment that it is not going to fund a movie that is outright anti-war. This movie is intended for a general audience, and a real anti-war film would likely bomb at the box office, no pun intended, and not turn any profits. Why? Because it might offend a general audience, which includes a lot of patriotic Americans who think that the A-bomb was an amazing scientific accomplishment. So no. Hollywood is not going to make an anti-war movie. A blockbuster film that still makes a profit has to be a compromise. It might raise a few moral questions about the bomb, but it cannot take a clear position on what amounts to the greatest war crimes in the history of the United States. An instant Holocaust, incinerating hundreds of thousands of innocent civilians instantly. And when you include the nuclear testing, oh my gosh, the nuclear testing alone. We're talking about the killing of more than 1 million people worldwide. So here's the thing with Oppenheimer. Just like with Barbie and every other movie Hollywood makes, the box office proceeds are what matter the most. Getting bodies in seats, not telling the truth.
Exactly. Because of capitalism and the need to commercially appeal to a mass, uninformed public, I see Oppenheimer as a huge missed opportunity to make a really strong anti-war film during a time when we need an anti-war message more than ever. This is a film about a very important part of our history, a part that is barely covered, and when it is, it feeds us false information. Oppenheimer could have been the JFK film of our day, a film revealing the truth behind historical events that need to be heard. I didn't want Christopher Nolan's Oppenheimer. What I wanted was Oliver Stone's Oppenheimer. And side note, according to a recent tweet of his, Oliver Stone actually had the opportunity to produce this, but turned it down. He did give Christopher Nolan's version a good review, but I still feel like Stone's version would have done much better.
Yeah, and I don't think Oliver Stone's Oppenheimer would have gotten funded, honestly.
And it's true that economically, Hollywood needs to appeal to a mass audience.
And given that most people in the United States are still largely uninformed about U.S. history and the level of atrocity that Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and the Manhattan Project actually represent, my guess is that Christopher Nolan just did not want to open that Pandora's box. So instead, he followed the book. He decided to focus very closely on the psychology of Oppenheimer, the man, how he was a genius scientist who studied the stars, a sort of leftist with communist sympathies, who gets swept up in the nuclear arms race and ends up designing the A-bomb without knowing exactly when or how it would be used. So Oppenheimer is living in this very pivotal moment when anti-war scientists are signing petitions against the use of the bomb, but Oppenheimer himself can't really decide what side he's on throughout the entire film until after the whole thing is over and the bomb has been dropped on Hiroshima. And then he, not we, start to see glimpses of the devastation, the nuclear fallout, and the story then follows his growing discomfort with the nuclear project over time. But the audience never sees any of the incineration, the mass murder, or the fallout. We don't see any of the impacts at all.
Yeah, and this is exactly the kind of film that Hollywood would produce. It's very typical of Hollywood to focus on the hero's journey and not to tell the story of a people, of a society, or even the history of an event. We just focus on this one white man's existential dilemma the entire time in the midst of this complete nuclear catastrophe.
Yeah. The perspective that this film takes kind of reminds me of Judas and the Black Messiah. Do you remember that film, Taters?
Yeah, Crawdads. Yeah, we did. We talked about that film in episode one, what the ruling class doesn't want us to remember about the Black Panthers. We analyzed that film quite a bit.
Right. And in that film, the director's main goal was to tell the story of the life and death of communist Black Panther Fred Hampton. But they decided to tell us his life story from the perspective of an FBI infiltrator who aided and abetted in Fred Hampton's murder. And when the directors were interviewed later, they said they would have loved to have told the story from the perspective of Fred Hampton or another Black Panther, but Hollywood simply never would have funded that movie.
Right. So here we see it again. The history of the A-bomb is told from the lead designer of the A-bomb, not from any of its victims. And we know that the movie was following the script of the book. So in a sense, they had to tell it from Oppenheimer's perspective, but they still could have shown the perspective of any one of hundreds of thousands of victims. But they didn't. They didn't show any of the victims' experience at all.
Exactly. And of all the glaring omissions in the film that we want to discuss, I think this is the most unforgivable. We don't see anything about Hiroshima or Nagasaki, nor the deaths around the Manhattan Project in New Mexico. We don't see any of the damage done. And I have to say, I've heard liberal apologists say, well, they could have shown the victim's perspective, but then that would have been an entirely different film. And that's right. It would have been a very different film. And that's a film we will never see in the United States, nor will we see any films that expose the actual effects of U.S. foreign policy and U.S. war crimes around the world. The United States is the biggest empire in the world with over 800 military bases. Our Pentagon has killed millions and millions of people around the world on every continent, minus Antarctica. And the United States public knows nothing about its own history. And that, my friends, is by design.
Yeah, and I'm sure we've murdered a few penguins in Antarctica as well.
You're right.
But exposing the truth about U.S. war crimes is not what this country does. This country creates propaganda to cover up its atrocities. The closest films I can think of that expose U.S. war crimes are maybe a couple films about Vietnam that show what a generally horrible war that was, unromantic depictions, Apocalypse Now, Good Morning Vietnam, Oliver Stone's Platoon.
Yeah, yeah.
But, these films are anomalies, and even then, it's not common at all to tell the truth about the U.S. role in war.
It's true.
Here's an excerpt from a Democracy Now! Interview with Greg Mitchell, journalist, author, and documentary filmmaker. He studied Hollywood's treatment of the atomic bomb for decades. He's written several books, including The Beginning or the End, How Hollywood and America Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb, Hiroshima in America, and Atomic Cover-Up.
Why don't we start out by talking about this truth that you don't feel was conveyed by the film. Though there's a lot on this film, because actually so few films have been made, feature films, narrative, dramatic films about the dropping of the atomic bombs.
Yeah, as I show in my book, there's really only been four. I mean, this new film is only the fourth. The first film, very revealingly, The Beginning or the End from MGM in 1947, started as a plea from the atomic scientists for a major studio to make a blockbuster movie that would warn the world about not continuing down the nuclear path and building bigger and more weapons. That got transformed after intervention from the Pentagon and the Truman White House and Truman himself into pro-bomb propaganda that supported the use of the bomb, supported making more bombs. It became almost kind of laughable, but it was released to theaters and
stood Greg, as the only film. If you can explain how the White House and the Pentagon got involved with that film, that first film.
MGM developed, I saw every script, dozens of scripts out at the Motion Picture Academy Library, and I charted, week by week, the changes in the script. As I said, it started out as a warning about the bomb and took some issue with the use of the bomb against Hiroshima. General Leslie Groves, who was played with some sympathy, I would say, by Matt Damon in the Christopher Nolan movie, was given basic script approval. And he made dozens, perhaps hundreds of revisions, big and small, in the script as it went forward. So it slowly became a justification for the building of the bomb and the use of the bomb and making more bombs, and certainly Groves' role. Oppenheimer himself, after raising some issues himself, basically caved and signed a release that allowed himself to be portrayed and serve as narrator of the movie. In the 1946, and then it went to the White House, where Truman himself took issue with a key scene where he's describing why the bomb had to be used. He ordered that the scene be reshot. He ordered that the actor playing him be fired because he did not communicate enough military bearing, as he said. And so there was a sort of remarkable situation where both the Pentagon and the White House were basically given veto approval over this film, and it was so revealing that this sort of set the stage for 78 years of this Hiroshima narrative kind of holding sway in this country, although not in much of the rest of the world.
Well, there you go. So Hollywood has exerted this kind of Big Brother type control over how the atomic bomb has been depicted in U.S. movies from the very beginning. And we'll put that Democracy Now! Episode in the show notes. But Greg Mitchell goes on to discuss how there have been four films about the atomic bomb in U.S. history. And all of them end up either whitewashing or justifying the use of the bomb. Maybe the film that took the most political risk came at the end of the 1980s. It was called Fat Man and Little Boy, and it was released in a period in the 1980s that was noted for a lot of anti-nuclear activism. There was more anti-nuclear fervor in this country than there has been before or since. But Mitchell talks about how even that film was definitely compromised by the casting of the great Paul Newman as General Groves and an unknown actor named Dwight Schultz playing Oppenheimer. So that made audiences very sympathetic to General Groves.
And now here we have Matt Damon playing General Groves, which again makes audiences kind of sympathetic to him. Mm-hmm. You know, he's presented as this stern general who recruits Oppenheimer to build the bomb. And although he's a total hard ass in the film, he's kind of funny and generally has more integrity in terms of defending Oppenheimer's reputation from political attacks. Here's a quick clip from an interview on the Socialist Program with Brian Becker, interviewing Greg Mello, a nuclear weapons expert and co-founder slash executive director of the Los Alamos Study Group.
Groves who had grown up in army camps at the end of the Indian Wars.
You mean General Groves?
Yes, General Groves, who was in charge of the Manhattan Project, who is played by Matt Damon, who makes him very sympathetic. He was extremely competent as an administrator, as a builder, but he was not a nice man. And he was a hard driver, and he was brutal.
So here again, like Paul Newman, we have Hollywood portraying General Groves as a stern but pretty decent and kind of funny guy, when he's actually this brutal military general who grew up in army camps during the genocidal Indian Wars. But Hollywood's going to stick Matt Damon in there to make sure we all like him by the end of the film. And here's another quote from Brian Becker at the Socialist Program.
You know, when I came out of the movie theater, Greg, I was struck by the first comment I heard out on the sidewalk was a middle-aged gentleman talking to his family, and he said, well, I'd be interested to know how much of that is actually true. And I was like, oh, wow. You know, because, of course, with however you spin the narrative, all of it was true. But again, there's this profound ignorance in the United States, and it's sort of an enforced ignorance because the U.S. mainstream media doesn't talk about this, but what could be bigger than the production of massive numbers of weapons that end life, if used, end life as we know it, not just human life, but all life?
Well, it's not all true. There's a significant amount of the film that's fictionalized, like the whole interaction with Einstein, but we'll get to that later. And most of it, you know, is true, and I'd hope people would know that. It is a biopic, after all. Oppenheimer did exist, and much of the dialogue was taken straight from historical record. Did they think they were watching Batman or another fantasy movie?
It just goes to show how little the general public understands about U.S. history. I don't know if U.S. audiences really understand capitalism enough to realize that this is the only way you can get these kinds of films funded in this country. You can't ever teach history from the side of the victims. Capitalism and U.S. imperialism ensure that the voices and perspectives of the ruling class will be the ones heard. So we learn to adore the Paul Newmans, the Matt Damons, and the military generals. And the greatest war crimes in history are centered not around the victims, but around the hero's journey. The journey of one white man, in this case, a scientist. And we just don't hear other perspectives. And given that U.S. audiences are largely uneducated about the general level of atrocity surrounding the atomic bombs, films like this one, I think, actually reinforce that ignorance and thereby reinforce the status quo support for the military-industrial complex, for U.S. hegemony, and for U.S. foreign policy at large, sadly. Our corporate media is a weapon and a tool of this brutal empire.
We are going to talk about several serious historical omissions in the film, but maybe the most glaring and shameful omission of any film about the atomic bomb is to not show anything about who the bomb affected. The hundreds of thousands of people who were instantly incinerated in Japan, and all of the downwinders and the victims of nuclear poisoning that has taken place over generations. So let's do a rundown of the damage that we know about in Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and New Mexico. And granted, there is so much devastation that we don't know about because there's no money in researching that. But let's start with New Mexico, since that is where the first bomb was dropped. The movie shows almost nothing about the human and environmental impacts of the Manhattan Project and the decades of nuclear testing that followed.
Yeah, apparently in New Mexico, wherever the film is screened, there's actually a 15-second public service announcement shown before the film that comes from the Union of Concerned Scientists. It's very short, but it shows a few scenes from the geographical area around Los Alamos and says, quote, Oppenheimer's bomb led to decades of nuclear testing across the Southwest. Communities still suffer health impacts related to the tests, many without government recognition or justice, end quote. That's barely a mention, but it's better than nothing, which is basically what we get in the film. Nothing. So who is living on the land around Los Alamos and the Alamogordo test site prior to the 1940s, Taters?
Yeah, I don't know why they didn't show us that public service announcement in every location.
Right? I know. What the hell?
Just only New Mexico gets this special treatment because they were directly impacted, but everyone should know about that.
Everyone. I mean, the downwinders are everybody.
Yeah, the entire U.S. was impacted. Anyway, so, you know, Los Alamos, New Mexico was the backdrop for much of the Oppenheimer movie. And in the movie, it is described as empty land, except for the occasional Native American performing burials. And this isn't true.
Of course not.
When the Army acquired the land, there were indigenous people and Hispanic settlers living on it. This included 36 homesteads of mainly Hispanic families.
Here's a quote from Rosario Martinez Fiorello, one of the descendants of the homesteaders. Quote, "They were frightened by these people in uniform. They came with guns and whatnot, and all of a sudden they came to them and told them, quote, well, you can't come and plant over here. We're going to take over. The government wants your land," end quote. And then Fiorello continues, "One of the things that was very hard for them to understand is that everything, maybe they wrote letters to them in English, but there was nobody to translate these letters for them." So basically, the government just came and declared eminent domain and kicked these people off their land.
Right. And, you know, the government did compensate them, but not to any great extent. There was a school and a ranch that were also on the same property, and they were compensated much more than were these Hispanic homesteaders, who received $7 to $23 per acre. And others were forced off their property by gunpoint.
Yeah, that sounds about right. This was also unceded Pueblo and Athabascan land, and these nations were not even consulted. The land was simply seized. Fences and checkpoints were set up, and they were prevented from carrying out their traditional and sacred activities on the land.
Even though in the movie, at least Oppenheimer suggests, quote, giving the land back to the Indians, this never happened. The Los Alamos National Laboratory still exists today on this same land, and the process of native land dispossession is ongoing.
Right. That was a good thought on Oppenheimer's part. You know, land back, good, but obviously nothing actually happened about that. Mm-hmm. Here's a quote from an article from Liberation News. Quote, "In May 2021, the Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico announced that the National Nuclear Security Administration Los Alamos Field Office would pursue an environmental assessment for the laboratory's electrical power capacity upgrade project. A 12.5-mile, 115-kilovolt transmission line erected through public lands within the Caja del Rio region, crossing the Rio Grande at White Rock Canyon. The transmission line would pass through Santa Fe National Forest land, as well as cross ancestral Pueblo Tewa land, thereby disrupting cultural practices connected to the sacred region, as well as diverting local resources for the increasing energy needs of the lab." Well, so that was just 2 years ago in 2021. You know, this is really an ongoing struggle. The United States government is still dispossessing natives of their sacred lands. It's really important that we understand this.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And what about the death and destruction that occurred around and at Los Alamos and the Alamogordo test site?
Yeah, there's very limited records, but these that exist show that during the Manhattan Project, there were at least 24 immediate deaths, 62 construction workers died, and there were 379 disabling injuries. And that was just during the construction of the Los Alamos Village, the area where they housed the scientists and the lab and everything.
Wow. That's quite a few deaths and injuries. They didn't show any of that in the movie.
No, the village just appeared in the desert in the movie. They didn't show anyone building it. It was just empty desert. And suddenly, well, here we are. Here's Los Alamos now.
Yeah. And it seemed like it was kind of this like 1950s Leave It to Beaver perfect family life at the Manhattan Project too, which is like obviously not the case if 379 workers were being disabled and
62 workers died and there were 24 immediate deaths. I mean, like, geez.
Yeah. Think of it like some kids drowned in a lake near there.
Oh my God.
It was not a idyllic existence.
Let's just say there was a dark cloud hanging over Manhattan Project from the very beginning.
Yep.
Ugh. A dark mushroom cloud. Okay, anyway, in 2017, the
Tularosa Basin Downwinders Consortium released a report, which we will link to in the show notes, called, quote, "Unknowing, Unwilling, and Uncompensated." about the effects of the Trinity test on New Mexicans. The U.S. dropped the first bomb at the test site at Alamogordo under complete secrecy so that no one was warned about what was happening. This report states, quote, "In reality, there were more than 40,000 people living in the four counties, including the communities surrounding the Trinity site."
Wow.
Downwind of Trinity, I know, 40,000 people. Can you imagine?
40,000 people. That's just in the immediate area surrounding where they decided to drop an atomic bomb.
Yep.
That they didn't know what was going to happen because they'd never done it before.
And they had no idea. They had no idea that was coming. They weren't
warned. 40,000 people, immediate victims of this atomic bomb test.
Yeah, that's just incredible. They didn't tell these people anything. And just like that sunrise, five in the morning, they decided to go drop this bomb without anyone knowing what's happening.
Yep, that's the U.S. government. So here's the second statistic from that report. Downwind of Trinity, there were cattle located on a ranch on the Chupadera
Mesa, about 20 miles away from the test site, that had the skin burned off their backs from the heavy fallout.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's hard to process. The skin was actually burned off of these cows.
Yeah, about 20 miles away. So imagine the people that were even closer than 20 miles.
The report also talks about the water systems of the small villages, ranches, and farms in the area in 1945, and how nuclear sediment contaminated the water supply. This report also describes how on the Mescalero Apache tribal lands, people were not living in structures built of lumber or adobe. Many lived in temporary structures made of tree branches or canvas. Their exposure would have been different from those who lived in permanent type structures. And I mean, we can imagine if this fallout was melting the skin on cattle, what it would do to a human who was, you know, living in a outside in a, you know, any one of these structures. It's just, yeah, awful. They were these indigenous people. There's this, you know, this reservation right next to the test site, and they were not warned.
Yep. Mescalero Apache tribal lands right there. So the National Cancer Institute reports, quote, "Perhaps several hundred cancers, primarily thyroid cancer, have already occurred over the 75 years since the test, and a small number are projected to occur in the future that would not have occurred in the absence of radiation exposure from the Trinity fallout," end quote. But again, the statement is perhaps. Perhaps this wouldn't have happened. Perhaps this, perhaps that. Since there's been no real funding
for these studies, we will never know the real numbers.
Right. Yeah, we know the numbers are high. I mean, that says several hundred cancers just as an immediate reaction to just this one bomb test. Also here in his book, Secret Fallout, Dr. Ernest Sternglass also notes a high increase in fetal deaths in fallout zones. And this report is backed up by the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. Here is some eyewitness testimony from Catherine S. Benke, a healthcare provider from Roswell, New Mexico. Quote, "As I recall, in August 1945, the month after the first bomb was tested in New Mexico, there were about 35 infant deaths here. I understand the rate at Alamogordo, nearer the site of the test, was even higher than Roswell."
Of course it was. The Trinity test was conducted on July 16, 1945. The rate of infant mortality began rising in July of that same year.
No coincidence. The month of August showed an infant mortality of 152.3 per 1,000 live births.
And then in September, it continued to rise to 187.8 per 1,000 live births. The New Mexico Health Department data indicated that the infant death rate increased by 38% in 1945.
Jeez.
And we can assume that increase was all due to the bomb test. There's no other reason for this anomaly of a 38% jump.
Exactly. So now let's jump to the present, more or less. In 2007, 62 years after the atomic bomb was tested in Alamogordo, a New Mexico study group called Concerned Citizens for Nuclear Safety released a report on the state of the contamination of groundwater from Los Alamos National Laboratory operations. Quote, Los Alamos National Laboratory is located on the Pajarito Plateau, which is comprised of volcanic tuff and has a very complex geology. Over 18 million cubic feet of radioactive and hazardous waste is buried in the mesa tops and in the shallow sediments along the canyon bottoms. 18 million cubic feet of radioactive hazardous waste.
Wow. Good. That's, I don't even know how much that is. That's a lot.
Yeah. Much of this waste is buried in unlined pits, shafts, and trenches. Few precautions have been taken to protect the regional aquifer located below Los Alamos National Laboratory. This aquifer is the sole source of drinking water for the communities of White Rock and Los Alamos. Likewise, the laboratory's own modeling indicates that the groundwater flows east toward the Buckman Well Field, where Santa Fe pumps 40% of its drinking water. Contaminants detected in groundwater include hexavalent chromium, nickel, high explosives, perchlorate, pentachlorophenol, I can't even pronounce these things, pentachlorophenol, and radioactive tritium, plutonium, americium, I'm probably not saying that right, cesium, strontium-90, and possibly neptunium. Already one Los Alamos drinking water well was closed due to the presence of perchlorate contamination.
Okay, yeah, I don't know what most of those things are. I assume having high explosives in your drinking water is bad.
Yeah, I would think so.
And anything with radioactive in front of it.
Yeah.
And neptunium, I don't think that's even supposed to be on our planet.
Right? Isn't that from another planet? Right.
I mean, with a
come from outer space.
With a name like that, I'm assuming that doesn't belong here, especially not in our drinking water.
I don't think that's supposed to be in our drinking water.
Yeah, that's a long list of very nasty things to be in the drinking water. And
Santa Fe pumps 40% of its drinking water from one of those wells.
Yes, that's the entire town of Santa Fe, essentially, is getting contaminated.
Large city.
And, you know, even though the public utilities company in Los Alamos reports, quote, excellent drinking water in the county, it takes just a little bit of research to find all these other reports just beneath the surface of the PR campaigns.
Yeah, I found another in-depth report that New Mexico PBS did in 2021 showing the prevalence of PFAs, also known as forever chemicals, in the water supply around Los Alamos.
Wow, so 2021, that's 2 years ago, very recent. This is ongoing today, like we said.
This is from that PBS 2021 report. Quote, for nearly 8 decades, Los Alamos National Laboratory has contaminated waters and soils with myriad hazardous chemicals and radioactive waste. Now, testing by scientists around the Mesa Top Nuclear Weapons Lab reveals widespread and in some cases extremely high levels of PFAs or per- and polyfluoroalkyl, I cannot say that, polyfluoroalkyl, substances, PFAs, forever chemicals. While most of the samples they collected revealed just traces of various members of the PFA family, some water samples ranged from 4,130 parts per trillion to 4,290,000 parts per trillion. That's 60 to 60,000 times the recommended lifetime exposure limit.
Well, okay. Even 60 times is bad. 60,000 times the lifetime exposure limit of PFAs.
Yeah.
In 2021. Yeah. Remind me never to drink the water around Los Alamos. That's ridiculous.
That's insane. And this is what happens after 8 decades of nuclear experiments at Los Alamos. Not just the testing of one atomic bomb in
1945, folks. We're talking about 8 decades of nuclear testing following that. And there's so much that we don't know about all of this contamination because it's classified and it's top secret. But we know that indigenous people have been fighting these toxins for decades. Again, here's Greg Mello of the Los Alamos Study Group.
Well, let's see. We started with Trinity. So let's talk about the post-war tests for a moment. There were, I believe, and there's a very interesting study that came out a few years ago that augmented the one by the National Cancer Institute. There were hundreds of thousands of U.S. deaths from U.S. nuclear testing. The number of deaths and the disability and morbidity that has come from these tests has been greatly underestimated. This affected an entire generation of Americans. The tests in the Pacific were huge. From one of them alone, Castle Bravo, there were really large amounts of fallout that fell all over the world, on Europe, for example. And I can't give you a number, but I would say that if you included the Soviet tests, I bet you there's a million casualties so far from these tests. And the effects continue because some of the radionuclides are still in the atmosphere, carbon-14.
Wow. There was, you know, no mention of this or the dangers of fallout in the movie at all. I don't remember any reference to nuclear fallout.
Can you imagine over a million deaths just from nuclear testing alone? And we're not even talking about the bombs in Japan yet. He's just talking about the nuclear testing and hundreds of thousands of U.S. deaths.
Yeah, this is something we never hear about. It's insane. Mm. You know, this, yeah, unintended, I'm sure. They didn't intend to kill all these people, but it was just a side effect. Like Greg said, you can't even estimate it, but up to a million casualties just from these tests.
No, he said easily over a million.
Easily a million. Yeah. Both the U.S. and Soviet Union are guilty of this. Open-air nuclear testing started with the Trinity bomb and didn't end until 1963. During this period, the U.S. tested over 200 bombs above the ground, including 100 at their testing site in Nevada. The others were mainly the Pacific and the Marshall Islands that had been captured from Japan after the war. You know, a lot of this testing, it came, obviously, all of it other than the Trinity test, came after the second use of the atomic bomb, which was Hiroshima and Nagasaki at the end of World War II in Japan, specifically against civilian targets.
I mean, how can a film about the atomic bomb and nuclear testing not mention any of this? Jeez. So let's talk about Japan. Let's talk about what the film didn't show, some of the horrors of what this bomb actually did in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It was subtly referenced in the movie because you see Oppenheimer having these fantastical visions. But if you don't know the history, you could just write off these visions as the delusions of a madman. The horrors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki are something that the U.S. public needs to be hammered over the head with over and over again, because we didn't learn about them in school, and we don't learn about them from our mass media.
Yeah, and this is something we can't even begin to convey over a podcast. You really have to look at the images to understand it. This is something everyone should be shown in school, and definitely are not. Here are a few numbers from Masao Tomonaga of the Atomic Bomb Disease Institute. Between the two bombings, there were 213,000 recorded deaths in the first 5 months, 140,000 in Hiroshima and 73,000 in Nagasaki. Another 150,000 were injured. And this is out of a total population of a bit over 500,000 in both cities.
Wow.
So, combined total of about 500,000 people lived in these two cities, and 213,000 people died in the first five months.
God. That's almost half.
Yeah, that's 43% of the total population of these two cities were just murdered. Basically,
wow.
Half of the people living in these cities were killed in the two atomic bombs.
Instantly obliterated.
Well, within the first 5 months, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, the ones who were instantly obliterated were the lucky ones.
Right. Ugh. Yeah. So basically the atomic bomb killed almost half the people living in these cities in the first 5 months.
Yeah.
And this was just the bomb's initial impacts. But let's talk about the cumulative deaths that are still happening even today from all the cancers, deformities, illnesses, etc., that are the ongoing effects of nuclear radiation. This is a very brief summary that comes from the Atomic Bomb Museum. In the first 2 weeks, people suffered burns from rays and flames and trauma wounds from the blast and the falling structures around them. From the third through the eighth week, you see symptoms of damage by radioactive rays, hair loss, anemia, loss of white blood cells, bleeding, and diarrhea. Approximately 10% of cases in this group were fatal. In the third and fourth months, we have some improvement in burn, trauma, and radiation injuries. But then come the secondary injuries, disfiguration, severe scar formations called keloids, blood abnormalities, sterility in both sexes, chromosomal damage, mouth lesions, and psychosomatic disorders, including post-traumatic stress disorder. And even now, over half a century later, many after effects remain. High rates of leukemia, atomic bomb cataracts, cancers of the thyroid, breast, lungs, salivary glands, birth defects, including mental retardation, spontaneous abortions, stillbirths, congenital malformations, and many fears of birth defects in children, plus, of course, the disfiguring keloid scars that are emblematic of that time. So by 1975, a total of 1,838 cases were diagnosed as leukemia in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. A 1972 large-scale survey revealed 3,778 cases of lung cancer and 10,412 deaths with correlation of high risks to radiation dosage.
Yeah, we could try to pull more mortality numbers for everything, but this gives you a basic idea, that the damage was horrific and it's ongoing still today.
Yeah. I think one thing that we need to understand in the United States that has never been made clear to us is that these were war crimes. The instant Holocaust, the mass incineration of civilian populations. These nuclear bombs were dropped on innocent people without warning. No country in the history of the world has ever dropped nuclear bombs on civilians, except the United States. And no U.S. president has ever apologized for these crimes. And this is part of why the U.S. public is so ignorant. We don't teach about this history. There is no institutional memory.
Yeah, it's not like we live in Germany post-Holocaust, where they make a huge effort to teach about the Holocaust in the public schools to make sure it never happens again.
Nope.
This country doesn't teach about U.S. war crimes, Holocaust, and genocides. So U.S. audiences are not on the same page about the horrors of these nuclear weapons. And to make it worse, Japan was ready to surrender when the U.S. made the decision to drop the bombs. This is another thing that was barely referenced in the movie. I think there might have been one or two lines referring to it, but it was very easy to miss. And if you don't know the history, you could watch the movie and not get any understanding of that at all.
Right. Japan was surrendering, in fact. That's something we definitely didn't learn about in our U.S. history classes. In fact, we learned the opposite. We were told that dropping the atomic bomb saved lives and that it was necessary in order to stop World War II. In reality, nothing could be further from the truth. Numerous historians, as well as the U.S. State Department itself, have documented that dropping these bombs was not necessary at all. Here's independent journalist Ben Norton on his podcast, Geopolitical Economy.
So let me start here with a little known document, which is very important historically. This is the United States Strategic Bombing Survey. You can find this at the Harry Truman Library and Museum. This is part of trumanlibrary.gov. This is part of the U.S. government's National Archives. This is the text from the U.S. Department of War's Strategic Bombing Survey. They say here, quote, "It seems clear that even without the atomic bombing attacks, air supremacy over Japan could have exerted sufficient pressure to bring about unconditional surrender and obviate the need for invasion. So once again, that's them acknowledging the nuclear bombing was not necessary. Here they say it as clear as day. Again, this is the mouth of the U.S. government. Quote, based on a detailed investigation of all of the facts and supported by the testimony of the surviving Japanese leaders involved, it is the U.S. government survey's opinion that certainly prior to December 31st of 1945, and in all probability prior to November 1st of 1945, here is the exact words of the U.S. government. Quote, Japan would have surrendered even if the atomic bombs had not been dropped, even if Russia, that is the Soviet Union, had not entered the war, and even if no invasion had been planned or contemplated. Let me repeat that. Japan would have surrendered even if the atomic bombs had not been dropped. This is the mouth of the U.S. government admitting killing, liquidating, massacring 200,000 Japanese civilians was not necessary to end the war. Japan was on the verge of surrendering anyway.
Wow. Well, I knew that Howard Zinn had written about this in A People's History of the United States, but I didn't remember that the U.S. government's own strategic survey had also quietly come to the same conclusion.
Yeah, you know, it was a quiet conclusion because the mass media didn't report on it.
Of course not.
So I'm going to read here directly from A People's History of the United States by Howard Zinn, which is a book that everyone should read. Skip your U.S. history book and just read this book. Quote, but could American leaders have known this in August 1945? The answer is clearly yes. The Japanese code had been broken and Japan's messages were being intercepted. It was known the Japanese had instructed their ambassador in Moscow to work on peace negotiations with the Allies. Japanese leaders had begun talking of surrender a year before this, and the emperor himself had begun to suggest in June 1945 that alternatives to fighting to the end be considered. On July 13th, Foreign Minister Shigenori Togo wired his ambassador in Moscow, quote, unconditional surrender is the only obstacle to peace, end quote. Martin Sherwin, after an exhaustive study of the relevant historical documents, concludes, quote, having broken the Japanese code before the war, American intelligence was able to and did relay this message to the president, but it had no effect whatsoever on efforts to bring the war to a conclusion, end quote. If only the Americans had not insisted on unconditional surrender, that is, if they were willing to accept one condition to the surrender, that the emperor, a holy figure to the Japanese, remain in place, the Japanese would have agreed to stop the war.
Wow.
Yeah, that's from Howard Zinn.
Yep. So the U.S. knew that Japan wanted to surrender in July of 1945, but Truman still made the choice to drop the two atomic bombs in August the following month. There is no doubt that besides being the most brutal of war crimes, that dropping these bombs was also strategically unnecessary.
Right. Yeah. So then the question becomes, you know, why did the U.S. drop the bomb if they knew that Japan was ready to surrender?
Every critical historian that we have researched has said that it had to do with the Soviet Union and showing the USSR who was boss on the global stage. Now, at first, this seems a little bit counterintuitive because the USSR was part of the Allied forces in World War II. We were fighting on the same side against the fascists in Germany. And in fact, it was mainly the USSR that defeated the Nazis in Germany.
Right. The Soviet Union did most of the heavy lifting in World War II. They liberated the bulk of the concentration camps and Berlin. And this is why they gained so much territory after the war, including East Germany.
Right. And we'll talk about this more in a minute because it's yet another glaring omission in the Oppenheimer film that it was the Soviets who effectively ended World War II. But again, the question now is, why was the U.S. so hostile towards the Soviets in 1945 if we were all fighting on the same side in World War II? Let's listen to a few experts speak on this topic. First, here's Greg Mello again from the Los Alamos Study Group.
You know, the project began because the War Department and the emigre scientist community was deeply concerned about the possibility that the Nazis would create an atomic bomb and use it to threaten the West, the farther West, and basically win the war. So it's important, I think, to know that in the beginning, people were looking at a deterrent. There was no predisposition to actually use an atomic bomb at the beginning. And first it was, of course, all about Germany. Then after Germany's defeat was assured, in fact, you know, as the Allies marched across Europe, it became clear from interviews with scientists who were in the occupied Rome and Paris that there had never been a German bomb program. So the narrative shifted to, we need to finish this bomb in order to defeat the Japanese. Well, then the defeat of the Japanese began to get closer and closer, and it became a race to produce the bomb before the Japanese surrendered otherwise. Mm. And people knew at the top, Truman knew, that the Russians were going to enter the war, and it became also a race to get the atomic bomb and likely use it. Well, the decision was made in May to use it in order to, well, as somebody put it, keep the Soviets in their lane, to keep them from conquering the northern Japanese islands. But most of all, in the conservative cabal that was in the War Department and in the business community, to assure American dominance after the war.
Right. And then Brian Becker responds to this.
Japan was about to surrender. Japan was surrendering.
Right.
And the Soviets, who had liberated much of Eastern and Central Europe from the Nazis in their counteroffensive that began in 1943, they were about to declare war on Japan, which had not yet happened. And they did declare war in early August. So one way or the other, Japan was going to be out of the war. So the race to build the bomb and use the bomb was not to defeat Japan, but in order to use the bomb. In other words, it was its own end.
Yeah.
Okay. And so here again is Greg Mello speaking about General Groves.
He said in the spring of 1944 over dinner in Los Alamos that this bomb is not about Japan. This bomb is not about Germany. This bomb is about Russia. And this was appalling to Joseph Rotblat, who was at that dinner table, because the Russians were fighting and dying by the millions to defeat the Nazis. And they were our allies. And there was General Groves saying, this bomb is really about subduing the Russians. And he told the Oppenheimer Security Clearance Board, that much, you know, what's in the movie there, but not this particular part of it, that there was never any doubt in his mind from 2 weeks after the point where he took over the Manhattan Project that the Soviets were the enemy. And the whole Manhattan Project was conducted on that basis.
Wow.
Yeah.
So
General Groves was in the movie, Matt Damon.
Right.
I don't remember him ever talking about that, saying the Soviets were the enemy.
No, but that was his position in real life.
Yep.
So it becomes clear here that the United States just really wanted to use the atomic bomb, even though no circumstances strategically called for it. Germany didn't have a nuclear bomb program. The Soviets defeated Germany in World War II. The Soviets were dying by the millions to defeat fascism. And the U.S. air bombing program in Japan was proving effective, as Ben Norton told us. And Japan was on the verge of surrendering. It was surrendering. And the United States knew this from leaked cables. So why did the United States drop these bombs to kill, maim, and traumatize hundreds of thousands of Japanese civilians?
To show the Soviets who was boss, you know, to keep the Soviets in their lane and to show them that they couldn't become the world's biggest superpower like the United States, to launch the Cold War and the next Red Scare, to keep communism at bay, you know, even though it was the communists who had defeated the Nazis.
Okay, we're back. So let's talk a little bit about the Soviet role in World War II, since mainstream U.S. history, as well as Hollywood, refuses to touch this subject. At the beginning of the film, it's clear that the U.S. atomic bomb is being developed in order to defeat the Nazis. But then at some point in the film, the Nazis are just kind of miraculously defeated without much explanation. And the film doesn't actually mention that it's the Soviets who defeated them.
Right. The film glosses over that completely.
Mm-hmm.
And this omission is huge, especially right now at this point in U.S.-Russia relations, for Hollywood to completely skip the fact that the USSR was our ally and was a major force in ending mm-hmm. World War II.
Right. It's like, hello, like we're in the midst of this major demonization campaign of Russia.
And Hollywood just kind of accidentally forgets to mention that the Soviets defeated the Nazis in World War II. Instead, the film just shows these disappointed US strategists basically saying, oh no, we can't drop the bomb on Germany now because those damn Soviets already did it. They beat us to the punch. Oh well, what are we going to do with this bomb then? Let's drop it on Japan. Because we've got to drop it somewhere. So that's basically a very gross summary of what the film communicates.
Right. Yeah, you know, it's important to note that the scientists who developed the atomic bomb believed in the mission of developing it because they wanted to kill Nazis.
Right.
A lot of these scientists were Jewish, so this was a worthy cause in their minds. And they were really pissed when they found out that it was going to be dropped on Japan. The bomb was supposed to defeat the Nazis. It wasn't designed to be used on Japan.
Right. And the film gave no thanks to the Soviets for actually defeating the Nazis. 27 million Soviets died defeating the Nazis.
Wow.
27 million.
That's a huge number.
Yeah, I mean, in 1940, the USSR's population was about
194 million people. So that means that roughly 15% or 1/6 of the entire population of the Soviet Union was killed defeating the Nazis. Yeah, can you imagine? Can you imagine the United States sending 15% of its entire population overseas to defeat fascism?
No, no, the U.S. would not do that. You know, instead, we're sending more than $120 billion to aid Nazis in Ukraine in order to fight a war against Russia, an unnecessary war.
Yeah, I mean, the irony, what a terrible irony. You'd think that the United States would be forever grateful to the USSR
for saving us from a Nazi takeover in World War II. This role that the Soviets played in this war would be something very important for US audiences to understand right now, especially in the midst of this new Cold War and mass demonization campaign against Russia. The USSR and Russia actually have a very long history of fighting Nazis from World War II all the way until today. In fact, Putin still talks about how one of his major missions in Ukraine is denazification.
Yeah, and if you understand the historic West versus East divide in Ukraine and the fact that the West has been backing neo-Nazi forces in Ukraine since at least 2014, then whether or not you support Putin's invasion of Ukraine, you know what he's talking about when he says denazification.
Right. And basically, the U.S. public has no context for understanding this because we've been totally misled as to what's really going on in Ukraine and the geopolitical interests that the United States has there. And we aren't taught about how it was the USSR who defeated fascism in Germany. And so U.S. audiences are going to have a tough time understanding that the Soviet Union and Russia have always fought against fascism.
Yeah, and now you have this ridiculous, brainwashed liberal accusation that Putin is a fascist.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just absurd because, you know, fascism is not something that can take root in Russia right now because of their history of defeating fascism.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, 27 million Soviets died defeating Nazis in World War II. That's a major historical event in Russia. 1/6 of the population died in the war. Everybody lost family members. It was a national trauma. And so there's no way that Russia would identify with fascists or Nazis, you know, even 75 years later.
Right. And this is a really important historical point that I
think U.S. audiences are completely missing. There are so many brainwashed people in this country And I don't think that most people in the United States understand, I don't even think they understand that fascism and communism are at opposite ends of the political spectrum. Fascism, i.e. Nazism, is a far-right project that has to do with the final stages of capitalism and capitalist accumulation. Communism is a far-left project that involves a worker state, workers seizing the means of production, workers running the government. And granted, it's important to note that Russia today is not communist, not at all. It's a capitalist country, and it's capitalist in large part because the United States helped dissolve the Soviet Union through foreign interventions in the 1990s. But we still have to remember that the Soviet Union attempted a communist revolution starting in 1917. The Bolshevik Revolution was a workers' movement. And so it's so ridiculous that Fox News and so many people in this country equate communism and fascism all the time as if they're the same thing. They're the opposites.
Yeah. And Biden is not a communist.
Yeah. Just for clarification.
Barbie is not a communist. Oppenheimer was at least in relationships with communists.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no relationship here between fascism and communism. They are opposites. And as we've defined many times on this podcast, fascism is associated not only with right-wing ideology, but with the dictatorship of transnational capital. And this is something that we covered in episode 6. World War II was a major opportunity for fascists like Hitler and Mussolini to amass all kinds of wealth by allying with global capitalists of the Industrial Revolution, which included U.S. corporations. The fascists got their public support by demonizing Jews, but you know, fascism's ultimate goal was and still is economic. And I recommend everyone go check out episode 6, The Best Way to Fight Fascism is to Fight Neoliberalism, where we talk about this more.
Yeah, we covered this history in depth in episode 6. And currently, the United States is sending massive amounts of funds and weapons to known fascists and neo-Nazis in Ukraine in order to defeat Russia and control the economy of Ukraine, its oil, its grains, etc. We've been discussing this at length in parts 1 through 3 of our Ukraine series. And ironically, you know, capitalist as it is, Russia is still trying to defeat the Nazi movements in Ukraine. And this fact does not in any way justify Russian violence against civilians, but it's a very important context and history that we don't teach here in the United States. And this Oppenheimer film certainly doesn't teach it either.
Yeah, I mean, you know, God forbid we connect the dots and realize that the Soviet Union and Russia have been fighting Nazis all along from World War II to today, and the United States has been funding the Nazis all along as well.
Ugh.
So let's get back to Japan for a minute, the atomic bomb, and the United States' real motivations in World War II. We've established that the U.S. didn't need to drop the bomb in Japan and that it had no real effect on ending the war other than, you know, murdering hundreds of thousands of civilians.
Right. And I'm going to admit here that I didn't know a whole lot about Japan's history during World War II. That's not something I ever studied. We always hear about the Nazis in Germany, but it's important to remember that the three principal partners in what was referred to as the Axis Alliance were Germany, Italy, and Japan. These were the fascist powers. They were the countries led by Adolf Hitler, Benito Mussolini, and the Japanese Emperor Hirohito. These fascist governments formalized their alliance through the Tripartite Pact. So the fascists were fighting against the Allied powers, which were led by Great Britain, the United States, and the Soviet Union. So not only was the USSR our ally in World War II, but as we've said, it was primarily responsible for defeating fascism in the war.
Right. And we always hear about how World War II was the good war because the U.S. was fighting fascism.
Right.
But it takes a critical reading of history to realize that the main motive of the U.S. government toward the end of World War II wasn't fighting fascism because, as we've established, the USSR had already defeated the Nazis and Japan was already surrendering.
Right. In fact, the timeline says it all. The Soviets had been liberating the concentration camps in early 1945. they launched their final offensive encircling Berlin in April of 1945. And later in April, Adolf Hitler committed suicide. The bombs at Hiroshima and Nagasaki weren't dropped until August of 1945, 4 months later. So Germany was no longer a threat at that point, thanks to the Soviets. So what was the main interest at that point? Actually, a better question, what was the main U.S. interest in World War II?
Well, here's an excerpt again from Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States. Quote, on August 8th, the Russians were due to declare war on Japan. But by then, the big bomb had been dropped, and the next day, a second one would be dropped on Nagasaki. The Japanese would surrender to the United States and not to Russia. And the United States would be the occupier of post-war Japan. In other words, the dropping of the bomb was the first major operation of the Cold Diplomatic War with Russia, end quote. Zinn goes on to describe a diary entry from July 28th, 1945. Navy Secretary James Forrestal is describing Secretary of State James F. Burns as, quote, most anxious to get the Japanese affair over with before the Russians got in, end quote.
So dropping the bomb wasn't just about showing the Soviets who was boss. It was really about claiming Japan for the capitalists and starting a new Cold War against communism. Again, here's independent journalist Ben Norton on his podcast, Geopolitical Economy.
And he writes, again, this is Foreign Policy Magazine, as mainstream as it gets. Attributing the end of the war to the atomic bomb served Japan's interest in multiple ways, but it also served U.S. interests. If the atomic bomb won the war, then the perception of U.S. military power would be enhanced. U.S. diplomatic influence in Asia and around the world would increase. So this is part of the narrative of the U.S. empire. The narrative is the U.S. ended World War II with the nuclear bombs, which were supposedly necessary, even though the U.S. government internally admitted that the atomic bombing was actually not necessary. And that helped strengthen the U.S. empire around the world, and especially in Asia, and it prevented Japan from going socialist, and it prevented Japan from becoming an ally of the Soviet Union. And I should say that the leaders of the resistance against Nazism in Europe, the leaders of the resistance against Italian fascism in Europe, were the communists. And similarly, in Japan, the leaders of the anti-fascist resistance were socialists, unified by the Japan Socialist Party. If the U.S. had not turned Japan into a colony, if it had not militarily occupied Japan from 1945 until 1952, and then created a right-wing puppet regime, which has controlled Japan since 1955 in a one-party right-wing regime dominated by the LDP party, the Liberal Democratic Party, the right-wing party of Shinzo Abe and his grandfather, the fascist war criminal. If the U.S. had not done all of that, the most likely historical scenario is that Japan would have gone socialist. That is what is likely would have happened. That's likely is what would have happened. Japan would have gone socialist. It would have become an ally of the Soviet Union. And then it would have become an ally of the People's Republic of China when the communists took over in 1949. So you would have the Soviet Union, Japan, and China as three massive communist superpowers. That is why the U.S. massacred 200,000 Japanese civilians by dropping the nuclear bombs to prevent Japan from going socialist.
Yeah, this makes perfect sense. Yeah, the ruling class in the U.S. has always been more concerned about the rise of socialism than the rise of fascism. So what if they had to kill 200,000 civilians to make sure Japan would be under U.S. influence instead of Soviet influence? That's a price they were willing to pay.
Wow. That explains so much. A potential alliance between Japan, the Soviet Union, and communist China could defeat global capitalism. This is why the U.S. bombed Japan after the war was essentially over, in order to claim Japan as its own colony and help install a right-wing government, which was friendly to U.S. interests for years afterwards. I mean, as we said before, Nazi Germany was doing financial deals with some of the biggest U.S. corporations leading up to World War II, like Henry Ford, for example. who was working directly with the Nazis. The Nazi state also seized many overseas factories during World War II, and it was U.S. financial capital that built them. A lot of U.S. capitalists were actually on the side of the fascists. Again, check out our episode 6 for more details on this.
Yeah, and of course, it was shortly after the war ended when McCarthyism began, the Red Scare, and the mass persecution of communists and socialists inside the United States. This was just the beginning of the Cold War.
Wow. This makes so much more sense than anything we were ever taught in school. I mean, the idea that the United States was ever fighting fascism in World War II is such a ruse. Of course, a lot of soldiers believed that they were fighting fascism, and they died for that belief. And a lot of lower level people, like the scientists at Los Alamos, like Oppenheimer, like all the Jewish scientists who were helping design the atomic bomb, they thought they were fighting fascism. But the United States government, especially under Truman and the right-wing neocons that were at his side, they were pushing for their own political economic interests, and they just wanted to make the world safer for global capitalism and claim Japan as their colony.
Yeah, and ironically, President Eisenhower, who came to office in 1953, openly wrote in his memoir that he believed the atomic bombs were never necessary to end the war in Japan. And he took a lot of flack for that. And, you know, considering that he was a top military general at the time in World War II, he would know.
Right.
Many senior military officials said the same thing at the same time, but Truman dropped the bombs anyway. This was not a military decision. This was Truman defending global capitalism.
Right. So let's leave no doubt. It's not just a couple leftist historians who are saying that the atomic bombs weren't necessary. It's President Eisenhower. It's the U.S. Strategic Bomb Survey. It's the U.S. State Department. This was inside intel that was known at the highest levels.
One last comment about the film. It was a very interesting choice made by director Christopher Nolan to portray Einstein as he did.
Yeah.
You know, if you've seen the film, a large amount of the movie revolves around a fictional conversation between Einstein and Oppenheimer. And, you know, we don't really know what Einstein and Oppenheimer discussed. They did know each other, but what is in the film is only imagined.
Right. And for most of the film, Oppenheimer is consulting Einstein and asking for his expertise. And Einstein just kind of pats Oppenheimer on the back and basically says, "Good work, Oppenheimer, developing that bomb of yours." And Einstein has nothing critical to say about the bomb.
Yeah, and this is the opposite of what the real historical Einstein had to say. You know, he was a pacifist. He was in favor of socialism. He was actually denied security clearance to work on the Manhattan Project in the first place because of his being a pacifist and a leftist.
Wow, the film didn't talk about that. I was wondering why Einstein wasn't working on the bomb. I mean, why would the U.S. government contract the lowly Oppenheimer when Einstein's just sitting around?
Yeah, well, because Einstein was against the war.
Right.
In fact, the scientists on the Manhattan Project were not even allowed to consult with him because of his politics.
Wow. Man, the film totally glossed over that. I mean, not even glossed over. The film totally omitted that. No wonder Einstein and Oppenheimer were always walking in the woods or sitting outside or having otherwise secretive conversations.
Yeah, conversations they probably didn't even have.
But, right.
Yeah.
But had they had them, they would have had to have happened in secret.
Yeah, definitely. Apparently, you know, Einstein did initially support the development of the bomb, but he came to regret it. And, you know, here are a couple of direct quotes from Einstein related to the bomb that were not included in the movie. Quote, "I made one great mistake in my life when I signed a letter to President Roosevelt recommending that atomic bombs be made," end quote. And, quote, "Had I known that the Germans would not succeed in producing an atomic bomb, I would not have lifted a finger," end quote. These are real Einstein quotes.
Yeah. So Einstein was fully regretting his own support for the development of the bomb, but this film doesn't show any of his anti-war or socialist politics. Is that a coincidence? I don't think so.
Nope, not at all. Why does Hollywood constantly whitewash history and not teach us the perspective of the victims of U.S. foreign policy, not teach us the Soviet side, the socialist side, or the communist side? not tell us that Einstein was a communist, at least a socialist. It's because of capitalism. It is not in the interest of the capitalists who run the government or the major movie studios to present us with these perspectives.
And the effing hypocrisy of Hollywood. There's a reason that Hollywood is involved in not just one, but two major labor disputes right now at this very moment. They're continually exploiting and abusing their own workers. So while the U.S. public is fixated on Barbie, and a few Hollywood stars are getting paid in the millions, the majority of actors in Hollywood don't even make enough to survive in this economy. Only 12.7% of SAG-AFTRA members qualify for the union's health plan, which requires that they make $26,000 per year. That means that everyone else, or 87.3% of union members, are making less than $26,000 per year while living in Hollywood. This is the working poor.
Yeah, that's hard to afford to live on that anywhere in the United States, let alone in California.
Oh my God.
And of course, you know, the Hollywood studios have said that their plan is to wait the strike out and let the strike funds run out and the actors starve. According to a report by Deadline News, quote, the end game is to allow things to drag on until union members start losing their apartments and losing their houses, end quote, a studio executive told Deadline. Acknowledging the cold as ice approach, several other sources reiterated the statement. One insider called it, quote, a cruel but necessary evil,
end quote. That's horrible.
Yeah, so that was a report from Deadline News about this ongoing strike. You know, obviously the studios could give their workers what they need to survive. They could negotiate, but their choice is to let them starve. And in at least one case, studios have also taken illegal actions to make the life of the picketing actors and writers more difficult. NBC Universal Studios happens to be the same studio that won the rights to Oppenheimer in a bidding war with Warner Brothers, trimmed the trees outside their studio to make sure the actors did not have as much shade for their picket lines.
Are you serious? That is savagery. So while NBC Universal Studios is making bank off of Oppenheimer, they are simultaneously trimming the trees back on their lawns to make their striking workers, their striking actors, die of heat stroke. That is complete savagery.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, the CEO of Disney, Bob Iger, who claims that the union's demands are, quote, just not realistic, end quote, is making $31 million a year. Just another day under capitalism. You know, Hollywood is never going to produce a film that's not in the class interests of the ruling class. They will never produce a film that will place workers' needs over capitalism, shed light on the capitalist corruption or the military-industrial complex, or even shed light on Barbie's untenable agency as a social change agent when her entire existence is a product of ruling class interests. And ironically, audiences are going to see these movies in droves, distracting themselves and tuning out of the real class struggle that is going on just underneath the trees on Hollywood Boulevard, that is going on right now. And instead, we are filling our minds with fantasies about Barbie's power to change the world or the status of women in society. Give me a break. It's so unbelievable. And from a Marxist perspective, what's happening, the way Hollywood and the mass media is throwing this eye candy in our faces while numbing people's consciousness to the real class struggle going on in the streets.
Yeah, and yeah, this isn't just Hollywood. Hollywood's just one example of this. It's really the entire ruling class. You know, in theory, Barbie and Oppenheimer are two competing films, competing with each other for consumers. But the owners of the big studios, all these large corporations, they're on the same side when it comes to the class war.
Absolutely.
And when it comes to the U.S. wars, U.S. foreign policy, the ruling class has direct control of Hollywood narratives. Like Greg Mello of the Los Alamos Project explained, Truman got directly involved in the first movie about the atomic bomb.
Mm-hmm. And of course, our own U.S. educational system reinforces all these ruling class narratives to young students to make us think that the United States is always in the right in every war. And by omitting all of our own nation's atrocities and war crimes against citizens around the world, the U.S. public receives a very highly skewed version of reality, which, of course, is supported by our corporate media as well.
This is what it means that our government, our military, our education system, and our entertainment industry are all controlled by capitalism. We will never hear perspectives that are critical of this political economy. And it's not just an economy, it's our politics as well. It's our education, it's our culture. And guess what now? Hollywood is working on a Monopoly movie.
Monopoly? No!
And this is what he said on his way to Armageddon. So long, Mom, I'm off to drop the bomb, so don't wait up for me. But though I may roam, I'll come back to my home, although it may be a pile of debris. Remember, Mommy, I'm off to get a commie, so send me a salami and try to smile somehow. I'll look for you when the war is over, an hour and a half from now.
Thanks so much for listening to Crawdads and Taters. If you like this kind of non-corporate independent analysis, please make sure to subscribe to the podcast and share it with your friends. And please consider becoming a monthly subscriber at patreon.com/crawdadsandtaters.
Because even though we're anti-capitalists, we still have to eat and pay bills. Even the smallest monthly donation allows us to continue. And remember, always be anti-fascist.
And anti-brunchin'.